out with the toe of his shoe. He opened the front passenger door, like a chauffeur. A minute later, they were driving down a wide boulevard of shops and apartment blocks. The breeze was still warm. A swastika pennant fluttered on the bonnet. Hartman didn't speak. He was concentrating on the road. His face in profile, with its high forehead and Roman nose, was imperious. Every few seconds he checked the mirrors. His anxiety transferred itself to Leggett.
"Is there anyone behind us?"
"I don't think so. Will you look?" Leggett twisted round in his seat. The road was empty. A gibbous moon had come up, and the tarmac was like a canal, flat and silvery. A few of the shop windows were lit. He had no idea of the direction they were travelling. He turned back to the windscreen. The car was slowing for an intersection. A couple of patrolling policemen in their bucket-shaped helmets stood on the corner. Their heads followed the Mercedes as it approached. When they saw the official pennant, they saluted. Hartman looked at Leggett and laughed at the absurdity of it, showing his large teeth, and for a second time it struck Leggett that he was not entirely sane.
"How did you get hold of the car?"
"I gave the driver 100 marks to borrow it. I said I needed it to meet a girl." The city centre had dwindled into suburbs and factories. Across the dark fields, Leggett could see the fires of furnaces and chimneys, scarlet, yellow, white. For a while, a railway track ran along the centre of the Autobahn. Then the road narrowed, and they were in open country. It reminded Leggett of the drive from Oxford up to Woodstock, and the pub they used to go to there, the Black Prince. After 10 minutes, he could no longer keep his alarm to himself.
"Is it much further? I'll need to get back to the hotel soon. The PM is an early riser."
"It's not that far, don't worry. I'll get you back before morning." They passed through a small Bavarian town, entirely shuttered and asleep, and presently entered the outskirts of a second. This, too, appeared entirely normal. Whitewashed, half-timbered walls, steep red-tiled roofs, a butcher's shop, an inn, a garage. Then Leggett caught sight of a place name, Dachau, and he knew why he had been brought out here. He felt obscurely disappointed. So this was it. Hartman drove carefully through the empty streets until they were on the edge of the town. He pulled up at the side of the road, turned off the engine, and doused the headlights. To the right was woodland. The concentration camp was on the left, clearly visible against the moonlit sky. A high barbed wire fence stretching as far as Leggett could see, with watchtowers, and behind them the low outlines of barracks. The barking of guard dogs carried on the still air. A searchlight mounted on one of the towers prodded ceaselessly against the vast parade ground. It was the immensity of it that was most shocking. A captive town within a town. Hartman was studying him.
"You know what this is, I take it?"
"Of course. It's been reported often enough in the press. There have been regular demonstrations against the Nazi repressions in London."
"You didn't join them, I suppose?"
"You know very well I couldn't. I'm a civil servant. We're politically neutral."
"Naturally."
"Oh, for God's sake, Powell, don't be so bloody naive."
It was the obviousness of it that he found most insulting.
"Stalin has vastly bigger camps, where people are treated even worse. Do you want us to go to war with the Soviet Union as well?"
"I merely point out that some of the people transferred into Germany by the agreement today may well end up in here by the end of the year."
"Yes, and no doubt they would have ended up here in any case, assuming they hadn't been killed in the bombing."
"Not if Hitler had been deposed."
"If! It's always if!"
Their raised voices had been noticed. Beyond the wire, a guard with an Alsatian dog on a short leash started shouting at them. The probing finger of the searchlight swung across the parade ground, over the fence and onto the road. It advanced towards them. Suddenly the car was filled with brilliant, blinding light. Hartman swore. He switched on the engine and found reverse gear. He looked over his shoulder, one hand on the steering wheel, and they backed away at speed, swerving from side to side down the middle of the road until they reached a side street. He put the Mercedes into first gear, swung the wheel, and they made a U-turn, sending up a spurt of dust and smoking rubber. The acceleration as they pulled away threw Leggett back in his seat. When he checked behind them, the searchlight was still weaving back and forth across the road, blindly searching. He said furiously,
"That was a bloody stupid thing to do. Can you imagine the row if a British diplomat was arrested out here? I want to go back to Munich now.
Hartmann continued to stare ahead and didn't answer.
Did you really drag me all the way out here just to make a point?
No. It happened to be on the way.
On the way to what?
Lena. So then, at last, Lena. She had wanted to set eyes on Hitler, not to hear him speak. She declared herself a communist, that would have been unthinkable, but just to see him in the flesh, this half-sinister, half-comical brawler and dreamer, whose party, only 4 years ago, had come ninth in the elections, with less than 3% of the vote, but who now was on the brink of becoming chancellor. Most nights during the campaign, after addressing one of his huge rallies, he returned to the city. Everybody knew the address of his apartment. Her proposal was that they should go and stand outside it, in the hope that they might catch a glimpse of him. Hartmann had been against it from the start. He had called it a waste of a good day, a trivial bourgeois diversion. Isn't that what you people call it? To focus upon an individual rather than upon the social forces that had created him. But there was more to his reluctance than that, Leggett had realized afterwards. Hartmann knew what she was like, the sort of recklessness of which she was capable. She had appealed to Leggett to use his casting vote in her favour, and of course he had done so, partly because he was curious to see Hitler himself, but chiefly because he was half in love with her, a fact of which all three were aware. They treated it as a joke, himself included. He was so much less experienced and worldly than Hartmann, still a virgin at 21. So, after their picnic on the grass in Königsplatz, they had set off. It was the first week of July, just after midday, very hot. She was wearing one of Hartmann's white shirts with the sleeves rolled up, a pair of shorts and walking boots. Her limbs were brown from the sun. It was about a mile distant through the centre of the city. The building shimmered like fantasies in the haze of heat. As they passed the southern end of the Englischer Garten, Hartmann had suggested they go swimming in the Eisbach instead. Leggett had been tempted, but Lena would not be put off. On they went. The apartment was at the top of a hill, facing onto Prinzregentenplatz, a busy, drearily impressive half-cobbled square through which trams ran. By the time they reached it, they were sweating and bad-tempered. Hartmann was hanging back in a sulk, and Lena had decided to goad him further by pretending to flirt with Leggett. The building in which Hitler lived was a luxurious turn-of-the-century block with a hint of a French chateau about its design. Outside it, a gang of about a dozen stormtroopers were loitering, closing off that portion of the pavement, obliging pedestrians to step into the road and walk around the Führer's six-wheeled Mercedes, which was drawn up waiting for him. Across the street, no more than 20 yards away, a small crowd of curious spectators had gathered. So he was in residence, Leggett remembered thinking, and not only that, it looked as though he was about to leave. He asked, "Which is his apartment?" "Second floor," she pointed. A balcony ran between two bays with French windows. It was solid, heavy masonry. Sometimes he comes out to show himself to the crowd. "Of course, this is the place where his niece was shot last year." As she delivered the last sentence, she raised her voice slightly. A couple of people turned to look at her. "Well, they lived together, didn't they? What do you think, Pauli? Gaily Raubel, did she kill herself, or was she bumped off because of the scandal?" When Hartmann didn't reply, she said to Leggett, "The poor kid was only 23. Everyone knew her uncle was fucking her." A middle-aged woman standing nearby turned and glared at her. "You should shut your filthy mouth." Across the street, the brown shirts were coming to attention, forming themselves into an honor guard between the door of the apartment building and the car. The crowd shuffled forwards. The door opened. Hitler appeared. He was wearing a dark blue double-breasted suit. Later, Leggett decided he must have been on his way to lunch. Some of the onlookers cheered and clapped. Lena cupped her hands to her mouth and yelled, "Niece fucker!" Hitler glanced over at the small throng. He must have heard. The stormtroopers certainly had. Their heads had all swung in their direction. But just to make sure, she repeated it. "You fucked your niece, you murderer!" His face was expressionless. As he climbed into his car, a couple of the SA men broke ranks and started coming towards her. They had short truncheons. Hartman grabbed Lena's arm and pulled her after him. The woman who had told her to shut her filthy mouth tried to block their path. Leggett pushed her out of the way. A man, a big fellow, her husband presumably, swung a punch and caught Leggett just below the eye. The three of them ran out of the square and down a leafy residential road. Hartman and Lena were in front. Leggett could hear the boots of the brown shirts thumping on the cobbles very close behind. His eye was stinging and already beginning to close. His lungs were searing as if they had been pumped full of liquid ice. He remembered feeling both terrified and entirely calm. When a side road appeared to the right, and Hartman and Lena ran straight past it, he swung down it, between big villas with front gardens, and presently he became aware that the stormtroopers were no longer pursuing him. He was alone. He leant on a small wooden gate to recover his breath, gasping and laughing. He felt almost ecstatically happy, as if he had taken a drug. Later, when he got back to their hostel, he found Lena sitting in the courtyard with her back to the wall. Her face was turned to the sun. She opened her eyes and scrambled to her feet as soon as she saw him, and hugged him. How was he? He was fine. Better than fine, actually. Where was Powell? She didn't know. Once the fascists had given up the chase and they were safe, he had shouted at her, and she had shouted back, and then he had walked off. She inspected his eye and insisted on taking him upstairs to his bedroom. While he lay on the bed, she soaked a hand towel in the basin and folded it into a compress. She sat on the mattress beside him and held it to his eye. Her hip was pressed against him. He could feel the hardness of her muscle beneath her flesh. He had never felt more alive. He reached his hand up behind her head and laced her hair between his fingers and pulled her face down to his and kissed her. She resisted for a moment, then kissed him back and swung astride him, unbuttoning her shirt. Hartman didn't come back all that night. The next morning, Leggett had left his share of the bill on the dresser and slipped away. Within an hour, he was on the earliest train out of the city. And that had been the only great adventure in the carefully planned life of Hugh Alexander Leggett, ex-Balliol College, Oxford, the third secretary in His Majesty's diplomatic service, until this night. They motored on in silence along the narrow country roads for the best part of an hour. It was colder now. Leggett kept his hands in his coat pockets. He wondered about where he was being taken, what he should say when he arrived. To this day he had no idea whether Hartman knew about his act of betrayal. He had always assumed he must have done. Why else would he never have got in touch in all the years since? He had also written to Lena, two letters full of love and remorse and pompous moral lectures. In retrospect, he was glad they had both been returned, unopened. Finally, they turned off onto a long drive. The headlights picked out neatly trimmed grass verges and low iron railings. Ahead was the shape of a large house, a manor house it would have been in England, without buildings. In a small round window beneath the eaves, a solitary light was burning. They passed through an arched gateway and pulled up on a cobbled forecourt. Hartman switched off the engine. "Wait here." Leggett watched him walk towards the front door. The front of the house was covered in ivy. In the moonlight, he could now see that the upper windows were barred. He had a sudden presentiment of horror. Hartman must have rung a bell. A minute later, a light went on above the door. It was open from the inside, a cautious crack at first, and then wider, so that Leggett could see a young woman in a nurse's uniform. Hartman said something to her, gestured to the car. She leaned around him to look. There was a discussion. Hartman raised his hands a couple of times, making some point or other. At last she nodded. Hartman touched her on the arm and beckoned to Leggett to join them. The hall smelled of overcooked food and disinfectant. Leggett registered the details as he passed them. The carved Madonna above the door, the notice board covered in green baize and studded with pins, but with no notices, the wheelchair at the bottom of the staircase, a pair of crutches beside it. He followed Hartman and the nurse up to the first floor, and a little way along a passage. The nurse had a large bunch of keys attached to her belt. She selected one, unlocked a door. They waited while she went inside. Leggett looked at Hartman, hoping for an explanation, but he wouldn't meet his eye. The nurse reappeared. "She's awake." It was a small room. The iron bedstead took up most of it. Her head was propped up on the pillow, a thick white nightgown buttoned to her throat. Leggett would never have recognized her. Her hair was cut mannishly short, her face was much fatter, her skin waxy, but it was the lack of animation in her features, in her dark brown eyes especially, which rendered her a stranger. Hartman went forward and took her hand and kissed her forehead. He whispered something to her. She gave no sign of having heard. He said, "Hugh, why don't you come in and say hello?" With an effort, Leggett walked to the side of the bed and took her other hand. It was plump, cool, unresponsive. "Hello, Lena?" Her head turned slightly. She looked up at him. For an instant, her eyes narrowed slightly, and it seemed to him that perhaps something moved there. But afterwards, he was fairly sure he had imagined it. On the drive back to Munich, Hartman asked Leggett to light him a cigarette. He lit it, placed it between Hartman's lips, then took one for himself. His hand was trembling. "Are you going to tell me what happened to her?" Another silence. Eventually Hartman said, "I can tell you as much as I know, which isn't much. We split up after Munich, as you might expect, and I lost touch with her. She was too much for me. Apparently she went back to Berlin and started working for the communists. They had a newspaper, Die Rote Fahne. She worked on that. After the Nazis came to power, they banned it, but it carried on publishing underground. As I understand it, she was caught in a raid in 35 and sent to Moringen, the women's camp. Apparently she was married by then to a fellow communist." "What happened to her husband?" "Dead. Killed fighting in Spain," he said it flatly. "After that they let her out. Of course she went straight back to the comrades. They caught her again, only this time they discovered she was Jewish, and they were rougher. As you can see." Leggett felt sick. He crushed the cigarette between his fingers and threw it out of the car. "Her mother got in touch with me. She lives not far from here. She's a widow, used to be a teacher, no money. She'd heard I'd joined the party, wanted to see if I could use my influence to get her proper treatment. I did what I could, but it was hopeless. Her brain was much too badly damaged. All I could do was pay for the nursing home. It's not a bad place. Because of my position, they've agreed to overlook the fact she is a Jewess." "That's decent of you." "Decent?" Hartman laughed and shook his head. "Hardly." They drove on for a while without speaking. Leggett said, "They must have beaten her terribly." "They said she fell out of a third-floor window. I'm sure she did. But not before they'd carved a Star of David into her back. Could I have another cigarette?" Leggett lit one for him. "This is the thing, Hugh. This is what we could never grasp in Oxford, because it's beyond reason. It's not rational." He weighed the cigarette as he spoke, his right hand on the wheel, his eyes fixed on the road ahead. "This is what I have learnt these past 6 years, as opposed to what is taught in Oxford. The power of unreason. Everyone said, by everyone I mean people like me, we all said, 'Oh, he's a terrible fellow, Hitler, but he's not necessarily all bad. Look at his achievements. Put aside this awful medieval anti-Jew stuff, it will pass.' But the point is, it won't pass. You can't isolate it from the rest. It's there in the mix. And if the anti-Semitism is evil, it's all evil. Because if they're capable of that, they're capable of anything." He took his eyes off the road just long enough to look at Leggett. His eyes were wet. "Do you see what I mean?"
Yes, said Leggett. I do see. I see now exactly what you mean. After that, they didn't speak for half an hour. It was starting to get light. There was traffic at last. A bus, a flatbed truck piled high with scrap metal. Along the railway track in the centre of the Autobahn, the first train of the morning was moving towards the city. They overtook it. Leggett could see passengers reading newspapers announcing the agreement. He said, "So, what will you do?" Hartmann was so absorbed in his thoughts, he seemed at first not to have heard the question. "I don't know," he shrugged. "Carry on, presumably. I imagine this is how it must feel to realize one has an incurable disease. One knows the end is coming, but even so one can't do anything other than keep on getting up each day. This morning, for example, I have to prepare a foreign press summary. I may well be required to present it to Hitler personally. I'm told he may have taken a shine to me." Can you believe it? It could be useful, couldn't it? To your cause. Could it? This is my dilemma. Am I right to continue to work for the regime, in the hope that one day I can do some small thing to help sabotage it from within? Or should I simply blow my brains out? Come on, Powell, this is too melodramatic. The former, it has to be. Of course, what I really ought to do is blow his brains out. But everything I am prevents me. And besides, the one sure consequence would be a bloodbath. Certainly all my family would be destroyed. So in the end, one goes on in hope. What a terrible thing hope is. We would all be much better off without it. There is an Oxford paradox to end with. He had started checking the mirror again. Now, I should drop you a few hundred meters away from your hotel, if you don't mind, in case Sturmbannfuhrer Sauer is watching. Can you find your way from here? This is the opposite end of the botanical garden we talked in yesterday. He pulled up outside a grand official building, a law court, by the look of it, festooned with swastikas. At the far end of the street, Leggett could see the twin domed towers of the Frauenkirche. Hartmann said, "Farewell, my dear Hugh. All is good between us. Whatever happens, we shall have the consolation of knowing that we tried." Leggett climbed out of the Mercedes. He closed the door behind him and turned to say goodbye, but it was too late. Hartmann was already moving off into the early morning traffic. Chapter 2. He walked back towards his hotel in a trance. At the busy intersection between the Botanical Garden and Maximiliansplatz, he stepped off the curb without looking. The blast of a car horn and a scream of brakes shattered his reverie. He jumped back and raised his hands in apology. The driver swore and accelerated away. Leggett leaned against a lamppost and lowered his head and wept. By the time he reached the Regina Palast 5 minutes later, the big hotel was coming awake. He paused just inside the entrance, took out his handkerchief, blew his nose and dabbed at his eyes. Cautiously he scanned the lobby. Guests were making their way down the stairs to the dining room. He could hear the clatter of breakfast being served. At the reception desk, a family waited to check out. When he was sure there was no member of the British delegation to be seen, he launched himself across the foyer towards the elevators. He summoned a car. His aim was simply to get back to his hotel room without being noticed, but when the doors opened, he found himself confronted by the dandyish figure of Sir Neville Henderson. The ambassador had his usual carnation button held in place, the inevitable jade cigarette holder between his lips. He was carrying an elegant calfskin portmanteau. His face registered surprise. "Good morning, Leggett. I see you've been out and about." "Yes, sir, I've felt the need for some fresh air." "Well, you need to get upstairs, quickly. The Prime Minister's asking for you. Ashton Watkins already on his way to Prague with the checks, and I'm off to catch a plane with von Weizsäcker to Berlin. Thank you for the warning, sir. Have a good trip." He pressed the button for the third floor. In the elevator mirror, he performed a brief inspection. Unshaven, crumpled, red-eyed. No wonder Henderson had been taken aback. He looked as if he'd spent the night on the tiles. He took off his hat and coat. The bell pinged, he squared his shoulders and emerged into the corridor. Outside the Prime Minister's suite, the Scotland Yard detective had resumed his former position. He raised his eyebrows at Leggett in a look of amused complicity, knocked on the door, and opened it.
"Found him, sir."
"Good. Send him in." Chamberlain was wearing a plaid dressing gown. His thin, bare feet protruded beneath a pair of striped pyjama bottoms. His unbrushed hair was tufted, like the plumage of a grizzled bird. He was smoking a cigar. In his left hand he clutched a sheaf of papers. He said, "Where's that copy of the Times with Herr Hitler's speech in it?" "I believe it's in your box, Prime Minister. Find it for me, would you? There's a good fellow." Leggett put down his hat and coat on the nearest chair and took out his keys. The old man seemed full of that same purposeful energy Leggett had noticed in the garden of Number 10. Nobody looking at him would dream he had barely slept. He unlocked the box and sorted through the files until he found his copy of Tuesday's paper, the one he had been reading at the Ritz while he was waiting for Pamela. The Prime Minister took it out of his hands and carried it over to the desk. He spread it out, put on his spectacles, and peered down at it. Without turning round, he said, "I had a word with Hitler last night and asked if I might come and see him this morning before flying back to London." Leggett gaped at the Prime Minister's back. "And did he agree, sir?" "I like to think I've learned how to handle him. I deliberately put him on the spot. He couldn't really refuse." His head was nodding slowly as he ran his eye up and down the columns of type. "I must say, that was a quite remarkably rude young man you brought to see me last night."
"Here it came," thought Leggett. He braced himself.
"Yes, I'm sorry about that, sir. I take full responsibility."
"Have you told anyone about it?"
"No."
"Good.
Neither have I." The Prime Minister took off his spectacles, folded the paper, and handed it back to Leggett. "I want you to take this to Strang and ask him to turn Herr Hitler's speech into a statement of intent. 2 or 3 paragraphs should be sufficient." Leggett's brain was normally sharp. Not now. "I'm sorry, sir, I don't quite follow." "On Monday night," said Chamberlain patiently, "in Berlin, Herr Hitler made a public declaration of his desire for a permanent peace between Germany and Great Britain, once the Sudeten issue was settled. I would like his undertaking redrafted in the form of a joint statement on future Anglo-German relations, to which we can both put our names this morning. Off you go." Leggett closed the door quietly behind him. A joint statement? He had never heard of such a thing. Strang's room, if he remembered rightly, was 3 along from the Prime Minister's. He knocked, but there was no reply. He tried again, more loudly. After a while he heard someone coughing, and Strang opened the door. He was wearing a vest and long cotton underpants. Without his owlish spectacles, his face was 10 years younger.
"Good heavens, you! Is everything all right?"
"I have a message from the Prime Minister. He wants you to draft a statement."
"A statement? About what?"
Strang yawned and put his hand to his mouth.
"Excuse me, it took me a while to get off to sleep. You'd better come in."
The room was in darkness. Strang padded across the window and pulled back the curtains. His sitting room was much smaller than the Prime Minister's. Through the connecting door, Leggett could see his unmade bed. Strang collected his spectacles from the nightstand and carefully put them on. He came back into the sitting room.
"Tell me this again."
"The Prime Minister is going to have another meeting with Hitler this morning."
"What?"
"Apparently he asked him last night, and Hitler agreed."
"Does anyone else know about this? The Foreign Secretary? The Cabinet?"
"I don't know. I don't think so."
"Good God!"
"He wants to get Hitler to sign some kind of joint statement, based on the speech he made in Berlin on Monday night." He gave Strang the newspaper.
"Is this his underlining?"
"No, it's mine." Strang was so disconcerted, he seemed until that moment to have entirely forgotten he was only wearing his underwear. He glanced down at his bare feet in surprise.
"I suppose I ought to get dressed. Could you see if you could get us some coffee? And you'd better fetch Malkin."
"What about Sir Horace Wilson?" Strang hesitated.
"Yes, I think so, don't you? Especially if he doesn't know anything about it either."
He suddenly put his hands on either side of his head and stared at Leggett, his neat diplomatist's mind plainly appalled at this departure from orthodoxy.
"What is he playing at? He seems to regard the foreign policy of the British Empire as his personal fiefdom. What an extraordinary business!"
Hartmann parked the Mercedes at the back of the Führerbau and left the key in the ignition. He moved stiffly. His night of driving had left him dangerously exhausted. And this, he knew, was a day above all others when he would need to keep his wits about him. But he was glad to have done it. He might never get another chance to see her. The rear entrance was unlocked and unguarded. Wearily, he climbed the service stairs to the first floor. A team of cleaners in army uniforms was sweeping the marble floors, emptying the ashtrays into paper sacks, collecting the dirty champagne flutes and beer bottles. He made his way to the conference office. Two young SS adjutants were sprawled in armchairs, smoking, boots on the coffee table, flirting with a red-headed secretary who was on one of the sofas, her elegant legs tucked under her. Hartmann saluted. "Heil Hitler. I am Hartmann from the Foreign Ministry. I have to prepare the English-language press summary for the Führer." At the mention of the Führer, the two adjutants quickly stubbed out their cigarettes, stood and returned his salute. One of them pointed to the desk in the corner. "The material is waiting for you, Herr Hartmann. The New York Times has just been telegraphed from Berlin." The sheaf of telegrams, as thick as his thumb, was in a wire basket. "Is there any chance of some coffee?" "Of course, Herr Hartmann." He sat and pulled the basket towards him. The New York Times was on the top. The war for which Europe had been feverishly preparing was averted early this morning when the leading statesmen of Britain, France, Germany, and Italy, meeting in Munich, reached an agreement to allow Reich troops to occupy predominantly German portions of Czechoslovakia's Sudetenland progressively over a 10-day period beginning tomorrow. Most of Chancellor Hitler's demands were met. Prime Minister Chamberlain, whose peace efforts were finally crowned with success, received the loudest applause of Munich's crowds. Beneath it was another story. "Chamberlain, hero of Munich crowds. There were real cheers, like the kind one hears in an American football stadium whenever the slim, black-coated Chamberlain, with a smile and a careful walk, came out." Hartmann thought it was exactly the sort of detail that made Hitler furious. He took out his pen. He would put it first. Strang, shaved and fully dressed, was seated at the desk in his hotel sitting room, writing in his small, neat hand on a sheet of Regina Palast notepaper. A litter of discarded drafts surrounded his feet. Malkin, a pad of paper on his knee, had pulled up a chair and was looking over his shoulder. Wilson sat on the end of the bed, studying the text of Hitler's speech in the Times. Leggett was pouring coffee. It was obvious by his initial, startled reaction that Wilson had not known what was in the Prime Minister's mind either, but by now he had recovered his usual equilibrium and was attempting to make it sound as if the whole thing had been his idea. Wilson tapped his finger on the newsprint. "This is the crucial passage, surely, where Hitler talks about the Anglo-German naval agreement. I voluntarily renounced ever again entering upon a naval armaments competition in order to give the British Empire a feeling of security. Such an agreement is only morally justified if both nations promise one another solemnly never again to want to wage war against one another. Germany has this will." Strang grimaced. Leggett knew what he was thinking. In the Foreign Office, they had come to the view that the 1935 Anglo-German naval agreement, in which Germany undertook never to build a fleet greater in size than 35% of the Royal Navy, had been a mistake. Strang said, "Don't let's revisit the Anglo-German naval agreement, Sir Horace, whatever else we do." "Why not?" "Because it's pretty clear Hitler took it as a nod and a wink that, in return for his letting us have a navy three times the size of Germany's, we would let him have a free hand in Eastern Europe. That was when the rot started." He jotted down a sentence. "I suggest we leave that out and just take the second part of his statement and tie it specifically to the deal over the Sudetenland. So, it would read, we regard the agreement signed last night as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again." Malkin, the Foreign Office lawyer, sucked his breath through his teeth. "I do hope the Prime Minister realizes this has no legal force whatsoever. It's a declaration of goodwill, nothing more." Wilson said sharply, "Of course he'll be aware of that. He's not a fool." Strang resumed writing. After a couple of minutes, he held up a sheet of paper.
All right, I've done my best. Why don't you take it to him, Hugh, and see what he thinks?
Leggett went out into the corridor. Apart from the detective outside Chamberlain's suite, the only other person was a stout, middle-aged chambermaid, wheeling her trolley full of cleaning equipment and fresh toiletries. He nodded to her as he passed, and knocked on the Prime Minister's door.
Come!
The table for two had been laid in the centre of the drawing-room. Chamberlain was having breakfast. He was dressed in his usual suit and high-winged collar. Opposite him was Lord Dunglass. The Prime Minister was buttering a piece of toast. "Excuse me, sir. Mr. Strang has written a draft."
"Let me see."
Chamberlain put down his toast, donned his spectacles, and studied the document. Leggett risked a glance at Dunglass, who widened his eyes slightly. Leggett couldn't read what he was signalling. Amusement, concern, a warning, perhaps it was all three. Chamberlain frowned.
"Would you go and fetch Strang, please?"
Leggett returned to Strang's room. "He wants to see you."
"Is something the matter?"
He didn't say. Malkin said, "Perhaps we all ought to go. They're as nervous as schoolboys summoned to see the headmaster.
Would you care to come with us, Sir Horace?"
"If you like."
Wilson looked dubious. "Although I'd caution you against trying to change his mind. Once he's set on a course, he'll never change it." Leggett followed the three men into the Prime Minister's suite. Chamberlain said coldly,
"Mr. Strang, you've left out the Anglo-German naval agreement."
"Why?"
"I'm not sure it's a thing to be proud of."
"On the contrary, it's exactly the type of agreement we should now try to reach with Germany."
Chamberlain took out his pen and amended the draft.
"Also, I see you've put my name before his. That will never do. It should be the other way round. We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister, have had a further meeting today."
He circled the titles and drew an arrow.
"I want him to sign it first, so that the onus appears to be slightly more on him."
Wilson cleared his throat.
"What if he refuses, Prime Minister?"
"Why should he? These are his own public undertakings. If he declines to put his name to them, he will only demonstrate that they were hollow all along."
Malkin said,
"Even if he signs, it doesn't mean he's obliged to stick by any of them."
"The significance is intended to be symbolic, not legally binding." Chamberlain pushed back his chair and glanced around at the officials. He was clearly irritated by their failure to share his vision.
"Gentlemen, we have to rise to the level of events. Last night's agreement settles one local area of dispute only. We may be sure there will be others. I want him to commit himself now to peace and a process of consultation."
There was a silence. Strang tried again.
"But shouldn't we at least tell the French that you're planning to seek this direct agreement with Hitler? Daladier is still in Munich. His hotel is nearby."
"I see no reason at all for saying anything whatsoever to the French. This is entirely between Hitler and me."
He turned his attention to the draft. His pen made short, neat movements, deleting some words, inserting others. When he had finished, he handed it to Leggett.
"Have it typed. Two copies, one for him and one for me. I have arranged to see the Chancellor at 11. Make sure there is a car available."
"Yes, Prime Minister.
This will be to go to the Führerball, presumably?"
"No. I suggested we should have a private talk, man to man, no officials. I particularly didn't want Ribbentrop anywhere near it. Therefore, he has invited me to his apartment."
"No officials?"
repeated Wilson, shocked.
"Not even me?"
"Not even you, Horace."
"But you can't go and see Hitler entirely alone."
"In that case, I'll just take Alec. He has no official standing."
"Exactly." Dunglass gave one of his lipless smiles.
"I'm a nobody."
After Hartmann had finished writing the press digest, it had been typed up by the pretty young secretary on the Führer's special large-print machine, 4 pages in all, a unanimous exclamation from around the world of relief that war had been averted, of hope that peace could now be made permanent, and of praise for Neville Chamberlain. In the latter regard, the Times of London was, as usual, the most effusive.
"Considering that, if the negotiations had failed and war had broken out, Great Britain and Germany would inevitably have been the protagonists on opposite sides. The cheering and the hails to the man whose action throughout the crisis has been single-mindedly and unchallengeably pacific must have seemed to have a clear intention.
Checking through the pages, Hartmann was forced to concede that there was some truth in this. In the heart of the Third Reich, in the very cradle of National Socialism, a British Prime Minister had managed to engineer what was, in effect, a day-long demonstration for peace. That was quite an achievement. For the first time, Hartmann was almost prepared to allow himself a flicker of hope. Perhaps the Führer would be denied his war of conquest after all. He refolded the summary and wondered what he was supposed to do with it. He was too tired to go in search of someone who might know. The secretary had gone back to her flirtation with the two SS adjutants. Their inconsequential babble about movie stars and sportsmen was soothing. He felt his eyelids begin to droop. Soon, he was asleep in the armchair. He was woken by a hand roughly shaking his shoulder. Schmidt was bending over him. The ministry's chief translator was red-faced, in his usual state of nervous agitation.
"My God, Hartmann, what do you think you're doing? Where's the press digest?"
"It's here. It's finished."
"Well, that's something. Heavens, look at the state you're in."
"It can't be helped. We need to get a move on."
Hartmann hauled himself to his feet. Schmidt was already heading towards the door. He followed him out onto the first floor and down the marble staircase. The building was empty and echoing, like a mausoleum. He wanted to ask where they were going, but Schmidt was in too much of a hurry. Outside, soldiers were rolling up the red carpet. The French tricolour had already been taken down. A workman up a ladder was just releasing the last corner of the Union Jack. It fell behind them, softly, like a shroud. He climbed into the back of the limousine next to Schmidt, who had opened a black leather folder and was leafing through his notes. He said,
"Weizsäcker and Kort have flown back to Berlin, so it's all down to you and me now. It seems like there may be trouble in Wilhelmstrasse. Did you hear?"
A prickle of alarm.
"No. What?" "Weizsäcker's assistant, Frau Winter. Do you know who I mean? Apparently she was picked up by the Gestapo last night."
The car swept around Karolinenplatz. Hartmann sat numb. It wasn't until they were passing the long pillared facade of the House of German Art at the bottom of Prinzregentenstrasse that the appalling realization came to him of where he was being taken. Carrying out the Prime Minister's instructions kept Leggett busy for more than an hour. He gave the draft declaration to Miss Anderson to type. He rescheduled their flight back to London from late morning to early afternoon. He spoke to the protocol department of the German Foreign Ministry to arrange transport to the Führer's apartment and afterwards to the airport. He called Oscar Cleverly at No. 10 to inform him what was happening. The principal private secretary was in a great good humour.
"The atmosphere here could not be more positive. The press is in ecstasies. What time will you be back?"
"Late afternoon, I should think. The PM is going to have a further private talk with Hitler this morning."
"A further talk?"
"Does Halifax know?" "I think Strang is briefing Cadogan now. The point is, he's not taking any officials with him."
"What? Good grief! What are they going to talk about?"
Leggett, as ever conscious that the line was probably tapped, said guardedly, "Anglo-German relations, sir. I shall have to leave it there." He hung up and briefly closed his eyes. He rubbed his hand across his bristled chin. It was almost 30 hours since he had shaved. The office was quiet. Strang and Malkin were speaking to London on the telephones in their rooms. Joan had gone off with Wilson, who had some letters he wished to dictate. Miss Anderson had taken the typed drafts for approval by the Prime Minister. He walked along the corridor to his room. According to the alarm clock, it was a little after 10:30 a.m. The maid had already been in. The curtains were open. The bed had been smoothed. He went into the bathroom, undressed, and ran the shower. He turned his face to the jet of hot water and let it massage him for half a minute, and then his scalp and his shoulders. He soaped himself and rinsed away the suds, and by the time he stepped out of the cubicle, he felt restored. He wiped a porthole in the mirror and shaved, quickly rather than carefully, skirting around the place where he had cut himself the previous morning. It was only after he had turned off the taps and was drying himself that he heard a noise from the bedroom. It was indistinct. He couldn't tell whether it came from a floorboard or a piece of furniture. He stopped and listened. He wrapped a towel around his waist and went into the other room, just in time to see the door being closed, very carefully and quietly. He threw himself across the room and flung it open. A man was walking away at speed. Leggett called after him, "Hey!" But he carried on walking and turned the corner. Leggett tried to run after him, but it was hard to move quickly with both hands holding onto the towel. By the time he reached the corner, the man was vanishing towards the rear staircase. Halfway along the corridor, he gave up the chase, cursed himself, and walked back towards his room. Malkin was just emerging from the office. He drew back in surprise.
"Good Lord, Leggett!"
"Sorry, sir." Leggett sidestepped him and went quickly into his room and closed the door. The wardrobe was open. His suitcase was upended on the bed. The desk drawer had been pulled out completely, and the book of tourist information was face down, open. For a few seconds he stared at it stupidly. The cover showed the hotel lit up at night. "Willkommen in München." He picked it up, flicked through it, turned it upside down and shook it. Nothing. He felt a terrible hollowing panic fill in his stomach. He had been unforgivably careless, fatally careless. The towel dropped to the floor. Naked, he went over to the bedside table and picked up the telephone. How could he find Hartmann? He tried to think. Hadn't he said something about preparing a foreign press summary for Hitler? The operator said, "Can I help you, Herr Leggett?"
"No, thank you."
He replaced the receiver. As quickly as he could, he dressed. A fresh shirt, his Balliol tie. Once again, he found himself kicking on his shoes as he walked. He slipped on his jacket and went back out into the passage. He realized his hair was wet. He plastered it down as best he could, nodded to the detective, and knocked on the Prime Minister's door. "Come." Chamberlain was with Wilson, Strang, and Dunglass. He was wearing his spectacles, studying the two copies of the draft declaration. He glanced briefly at Leggett. "Yes?" Leggett said, "Forgive me, Prime Minister, but I'd like to make a suggestion with regard to your visit to Hitler."
"What?"
"That I should accompany you."
"No, that's quite impossible. I thought I made it clear, no officials.
I am not proposing myself as an official, sir, but as a translator. I'm the only one of us who speaks German. I can make sure that your words are being accurately reported to Hitler and his to you." Chamberlain frowned.
"I hardly think that's necessary.
Dr. Schmidt is very professional." He returned to his perusal of the documents, and that might have been that, but Wilson spoke. "With respect, Prime Minister, remember what happened at Berchtesgaden when Ribbentrop refused to give us a copy of Schmidt's notes of your first long private conversation with Hitler? To this day, we don't have a full record. It would have been a great help to us if there had been a British translator present."
Strang nodded in agreement.
"That's certainly true."
Chamberlain could be peevish when he felt he was being pressured. "But it would threaten to change the whole tenor of the meeting. I want him to feel this is very much a personal conversation."
He slipped the two copies of the declaration into his inside pocket.
Wilson looked at Leggett and shrugged slightly. He had tried. A noise came from beyond the window. Chamberlain's brow creased in puzzlement.
"What is that sound?"
Strang pulled back the curtain fractionally.
"There is a huge crowd in the street, Prime Minister. They're calling for you."
"Not again,"
Wilson said.
"You should go out onto the balcony and wave to them."
Chamberlain smiled.
"I don't think so."
"You must. Hugh, open the window, will you?" Leggett undid the catch. In the garden opposite the hotel, and in both directions along the street, the crowd was even greater than it had been on the previous day. As the spectators noticed the French windows opening, they began to roar, and when Leggett stood back to allow Chamberlain to step onto the small balcony, the din became tremendous. Chamberlain bowed modestly three or four times in each direction and waved. They started to chant his name. In the hotel suite, the four men listened. Strang said quietly,
"Perhaps he's right. Perhaps this is the one moment when Hitler can be persuaded by sheer force of popular opinion to moderate his behaviour."
"You can't accuse the PM of lacking imagination," said Wilson, "or courage. Even so, with great respect to Alec, I'd be happier if one of us was in there with him."
After a couple of minutes, Chamberlain came back into the room. The adulation seemed to have energized him. His face glowed. His eyes were unnaturally bright.
How very humbling. You see, gentlemen, it is the same in every country. Ordinary people, the world over, want nothing more than to live their lives in peace, to cherish their children and their families, and to enjoy the fruits that nature, art, and science have to offer them. That is what I wish to say to Hitler.
He brooded for a moment, then turned to Wilson.
Do you really think we can't trust Schmidt?
It's not Schmidt who concerns me, Prime Minister. It's Ribbentrop. Chamberlain thought it over.
Oh, very well, he said at last. But be discreet,
he warned Leggett.
Don't take notes. I only want you to intervene if my meaning is not being properly rendered. And make sure you keep out of his line of sight.
Chapter 3 Prinzregententplatz had scarcely changed in the 6 years since Hartmann had last seen it. As they came up the hill and rounded the bend, his eyes went immediately to the spot in the northeast corner where he had stood with Hugh and Lena, on a pavement beneath a large white stone apartment building with a high red slate roof. A similar-sized crowd had gathered in the same place today, hoping for a glimpse of the leader. The Mercedes drew up outside number 16. A pair of SS sentries guarded the entrance. Seeing them, Hartmann realized he was still carrying his gun. He'd grown so used to its snug weight, he kept forgetting he even had it. He ought to have dumped it during the night. If they'd picked up Frau Winter, he must surely be next. He wondered where they had picked her up, at the office or in her apartment, and how they were treating her. As he climbed out of the car after Schmidt, he could feel the sweat trickling beneath his shirt. The guards recognized Schmidt and waved him through, and Hartmann slipped in after him. He was not even asked his name. They passed another pair of SS men in the concierge's office and climbed the communal staircase, stone at first that became polished wood. The walls were lined in institutional grey and green, as in a metro system. There were dim electric lamps, but the light came mostly from the landing windows that looked out onto a small rear garden of fir and silver birch trees. They clumped up noisily, past apartments on the ground and first floors. It was said by the propaganda ministry that the Führer still had the same neighbours as he did before he became Chancellor, proof that at heart he remained a simple member of the Volk. Perhaps it was true, thought Hartmann, in which case what strange goings-on these people must have seen over the past few years, from the death of Hitler's niece in 1931 to yesterday's lunchtime visit by Mussolini. They continued to climb. He felt trapped, as if he was being pulled relentlessly by some dark magnetic force. He slowed his pace.
"Come on," said Schmidt. "Keep up."
On the second floor, nothing distinguished the apartment's solid double door from the others. Schmidt knocked, and they were admitted by an SS adjutant into a long, narrow vestibule. It stretched away on either side, parquet-floored, with rugs, paintings, sculptures. The atmosphere was silent, unhomely, unlived in. The adjutant invited them to sit. "The Führer is not yet ready." He moved away. Schmidt whispered confidingly,
"He keeps late hours. Often he doesn't emerge from his bedroom until noon."
"You mean we may have to sit here for another hour?"
"Not today. Chamberlain is due at 11.
Hartmann gave him a look of surprise. It was the first he knew that Hitler was meeting the British Prime Minister. It took Chamberlain's car several minutes to break free from the clutching hands of the crowd around the front of the hotel. The Prime Minister rode in the back with Dunglass. Leggett sat up front next to the driver. Behind them was a second Mercedes, carrying the Prime Minister's two bodyguards. They made a partial circuit of the square and then sped off across Odeonsplatz into a district of elaborate royal palaces and grand public buildings that Leggett vaguely remembered from 1932. He studied Chamberlain in the wing mirror, gazing rigidly ahead. People were shouting his name, waving at him. He sped on, oblivious. He was no longer the dry-as-dust administrator of popular legend, thought Leggett. He had become a seer, a messiah of peace, robed in the drab costume of an elderly accountant. They drove onto a bridge with a stone balustrade. The river was wide and green, the strip of trees along the embankment an advancing line of fire, red, gold, orange. The sun lit the gilded figure of the Angel of Peace leaning forwards on top of her high stone column. Beyond the monument, the road looped through a park. Emerging, they began to climb the slope of Prinzregentenstrasse. He had always pictured it as steep, in the way that one misremembers scenes from childhood, but now, in a powerful car, it seemed no more than a gentle incline. They passed the theatre on the right, and suddenly they were in the space in front of Hitler's apartment, and this was exactly as he had carried it in his mind, right down to the crowd on the pavement, who recognised Chamberlain and started to cheer. Again, the Prime Minister, in his mystic state, didn't even glance across at them. The guards saluted, and an adjutant stepped forward to open the car door. Leggett let himself out, walked around the front of the Mercedes, and followed Chamberlain and Dunglass through the entrance and up the steps into the gloomy interior. The adjutant showed the Prime Minister into a small, caged elevator and pressed the button, but it failed to move. He tried for another half minute, his handsome young face turning red with embarrassment. Finally, he had to pull open the gate and indicate they should proceed on foot. Leggett fell in beside Dunglass as they climbed the stairs behind Chamberlain. Dunglass whispered,
"No ink last night. Hardly any telephones that work. I don't think these chaps are quite as efficient as they like to make out."
Leggett was praying that Hartmann would be there. He was not sure what he could offer God in return, but it would be something, he promised him, a different life, a fresh start, a gesture equal to the age. They arrived at the second floor. The adjutant opened the door to the apartment, and there, mirabile dictu, was Hartmann, sitting with his long legs stretched out. Beside him, Leggett recognised Hitler's translator. They both stood when they saw Chamberlain. Hartmann stared at Leggett, but there was no opportunity for anything more than a glance to pass between them. The adjutant was insisting Leggett follow Chamberlain and Dunglass across the hall and into the room opposite. He told Schmidt to come too. Hartmann made a move to accompany them, but the adjutant shook his head. "Not you. Wait here." For a few seconds Hartmann stood alone in the empty lobby. Leggett's brief glance had been full of warning. Something else must have happened. He wondered if he should slip away while he still had the chance. Then he heard a noise to his right and turned to see Hitler emerging from a room at the far end of the corridor. He was smoothing his hair and straightening his brown party jacket, checking his armband, fussy, last-minute adjustments, like an actor about to go on stage. Hartmann jumped to his feet and saluted, "Heil Hitler!" Hitler looked at him and raised his hand in acknowledgement, but gave no sign of recognition. He stepped into the room in which the others were waiting, and the door was closed behind him. Afterwards, Leggett would be able to claim, not boast, that was never his style, that he had been in the same room as Hitler on three separate occasions, twice at the Führerbau and once in his apartment. But, like most of the British eyewitnesses at Munich, he was never able to provide anything more than the most commonplace description. Hitler looked as he looked in the photographs and the newsreels, except in colour, and the main shock of the encounter lay simply in finding oneself in proximity to a world-famous phenomenon, like seeing the Empire State Building or Red Square for the first time. One detail stuck in his mind, though. Hitler smelled strongly of sweat. He had detected it in his study and caught a whiff of it now as he passed. He had the body odour of a frontline soldier, or a workman who had not bathed or changed his shirt for a week. He was yet again in a dour mood, and made no attempt to hide it. He stalked in, greeted Chamberlain, ignored everyone else, then went and sat in the furthest corner of the room, and waited for his visitor to join him. The Prime Minister took the armchair to his right. Schmidt sat on his left. The adjutant stationed himself by the door. It was a big room, running almost the entire length of the apartments, looking out onto the street. It was furnished in a modern style, like a salon aboard a luxury liner. There was a library alcove at the far end, crammed with books, where Hitler and Chamberlain were sitting, an area of sofas and chairs in the middle, where Leggett and Dunglass had perched themselves, and a dining table at the opposite end. Leggett was close enough to hear what was said, but far enough distant not to impinge on the conversation. However, because Hitler was in the corner, it was impossible for him to obey the Prime Minister's instruction and entirely escape the dictator's eyeline, and from time to time he noticed those strangely opaque blue eyes flicker in his direction, as if he was trying to work out